Til å avslutte konferansen så vi glad for å kunne ønske velkommen en mann som både han har kjempet mange kamper, han har både kjempet mot apartheid i Sør-Afrika og også kjempet internasjonalt både mot fattigdom og for menneskerettigheter. Uten noen mer forsinkelser, please welcome International Executive Director of Greenpeace, Mr. Kumi Naidoo. So pleased to see you.
Dear friends, colleagues, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, let me say to you how honored and pleased I am to be here with you today. Because whether you know it or not, you are making history in this conference and the processes related to building this momentum of bringing the faith organizations, labor unions, and NGOs together. Sadly to say, there are very few countries in the world where there is a coming together as much as I see in the work that you'll have been doing here over the last couple of years. In fact, when I joined Greenpeace 5.5 years ago, one of my main missions was to promote the idea that the challenge of climate change is far too big for NGOs to win it alone. It's far too big for trade unions or faith-based organizations to win it alone. That the only chance we had was to work together. In fact, on a lighter note, I should tell you that my background is more in the human rights and anti-poverty and labor support work. So when I joined Greenpeace as a non-traditional environmentalist, one of my colleagues, after some speeches I gave, came up to me and said, Kumi, some of us are wondering whether you are a watermelon. I said, watermelon? What does that mean? And they said, green on the outside, red on the inside. So where we are today is the brutal truth is that most of our political and business leaders, globally speaking, are in denial about how fast we are running out of time in terms of addressing climate. You might remember in Copenhagen in 2009, we were then fighting for our leaders in Copenhagen to come up with a plan that would allow emissions to peak in 2015 and start coming down. Some of you might remember we were calling for a fair, ambitious, and binding climate treaty. Sadly, what we got in Copenhagen was a flab deal, F-L-A-B, full of loopholes and bull. So our political and business leaders, your inspiration here of bringing together the three core legs of civil society is saying in a very loud way that nature does not negotiate, that we cannot change the science, that all that is within our grasp is to change political will. Now, one key compromise that was made in Copenhagen was an agreement about how much of warming the planet could absorb from the time we started burning fossil fuels. And some of you might remember there was a big debate about whether it should be 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees. Small island states and least developed countries were saying it has to be 1.5 degrees and no more. Developed countries and emerging economies were saying 2 degrees. And the compromise was a language that said as far below 2 degrees as possible. Does anybody here know where we are now? Okay, I would imagine. Sorry? 0.85. Okay? Now, at 0.85, in the last 10 years, we have seen more than 100% increase in extreme weather events. More than 100% increase in extreme weather events. Sadly, in places where people have been least responsible for carbon emissions. The first and the most brutal price is being paid by those that have been least responsible for emissions. And let's be very clear. The impacts of climate change are very, very much with us today. Already in 2009, the figure that was being quoted was more than 400,000 people were losing their lives directly from climate impacts. So when we look at a country like Norway, one of the wealthy countries in the world, what is the place that Norway holds in all of this? As a young South African growing up under apartheid, Norway and the Scandinavian countries generally held a very unique place. Norway does have, justifiably, a very positive image in many parts of the world, especially in the developing world. For one, you meet your obligation in terms of 0.7% of international aid, and in fact you surpass it at 1%. But now people in the developing world, in Africa and Asia and so on, are saying, well, actually, how does that add up? So you are giving us, you're meeting your international aid commitments in giving us resources for education, health, and so on. But actually, you're continuing to be hooked on an oil economy, and that burning of oil is what's actually causing us to lose our agriculture, to have water scarcity, and so on. So there's a dilemma about how a country like Norway is, will be seen moving forward if you cannot keep the momentum of those inspirational stories that I had the benefit of hearing of divestment from fossil fuels, from pension funds, and the many positive things that people are doing at the grassroots level. I want to applaud your efforts at building this coalition, because already you are seeing some positive results. I believe that the Oslo municipality decision to divest from coal assets is not unmindful of the fact that such a coalition exists, and you can take some credit from him. And I hope that later this year, when the Norwegian government has to apply itself to whether the Norwegian oil fund diverts from coal, I hope that they will listen to you and actually make that decision. It is critically important that we recognize that climate change is not solely an environmental issue, and as the presentations you've heard has shown it. It is a cross-cutting issue. It's an issue of the economy. It's the issue of peace. It's the issue of women. It's why I say women, because we know that in every war and conflict, women and children pay a disproportional price. And I might surprise some of you who know my general speeches and my writing when I start my next sentence like I'm about to. I strongly support the CIA and the Pentagon when in 2003 they said to President Bush, based on a very thoughtful study that they had done, that in the coming decades, the biggest threat to peace, security, and stability will not come from traditional threats, will not come from terrorism, but will actually come from the climate impacts. And my dear brothers and sisters, when you look at the genocide in Darfur, understand that that is the first major resource war brought about as a result of climate impacts. Lake Chad was one of the largest inland seas in the world, and according to Ban Ki-moon, is now the size of a pond, and the Sahel Desert is marching southwards. Land scarcity, water scarcity, combined food scarcity was a toxic mix that allowed opportunistic politicians to manipulate identity for their own interests. So one of my challenges in my job is speaking at conferences like this, where people always expect you to be inspiring and motivating. And so I just want to say to you, my dilemma is this. And I'll put it to you in an anecdote. I was speaking in a conference in the US where I was saying how we are running out of time on oceans, on forests, on climate, and particularly climate. And an irate woman in the audience at the end of the speech put up her hands and said, Dr. Naidu, have you heard of Martin Luther King? And I said, yes. And she said, well, do you know what his most famous speech was called? I said, I think so. I have a dream. And she said, yes! It was I have a dream, but when I hear you speak, it sounds like you have a nightmare. So we, my dear brothers and sisters, have a challenge. Because we cannot lie to people about the urgency of the moment we're in. But on the other hand, we have to also not talk about it in a way that people are disempowered, where they feel it's too late, we cannot change. Because change becomes possible when people believe that change is possible. If that's one thing I've learned, if there's one thing I learned from the anti-apartheid struggle, we started winning and moving forward when enough of us said, irrespective of how powerful the army of the apartheid state was, irrespective of the fact that most of the dominant countries in the world, from the United States, Germany, UK, and so on, were backing the apartheid regime, but irrespective of all that, when enough of us believed that change was possible, we believed that Nelson Mandela will walk out of prison, that's when the apartheid state could not hold us back. And I believe that momentum is coming. And let me give you a few examples to tell you that, in fact, we have reason to be optimistic. One is, last year alone, China installed as much solar power capacity as the U.S. has done in its entire lifetime. And China's coal boom, at last, seems to be coming to an end, and the trend is going the other way. That's one trend. Second, in Germany, the decision to phase out nuclear power while still achieving ambitious climate targets has created a flourishing new renewable energy sector that has generated thousands and thousands of clean climate jobs. Even in the US, by the way, third example, the solar power sector alone employs more people now today than the entire coal sector combined. Now, there's another good news that I want to say to you. And that is, I'm saying this a bit tongue-in-cheek. The good news is, we in the environmental movement like to often say, save the planet. I have good news. We don't have to worry about saving the planet. The planet, dear brothers and sisters, doesn't need saving. Why do I say that? If we warm up this planet to the point that humanity cannot exist on it, the planet will still be here. It'll be bruised, battered, and scarred by humanity's crimes on it. But actually, if we are gone, the forests will replenish, the oceans will replenish, and so on. So let's be very clear what is at stake. This struggle is about whether humanity can fashion a way to coexist with nature in a mutually interdependent way for centuries and centuries to come. Put differently, this struggle is fundamentally about securing our children and their children's future. And that includes whether they will have decent work, whether they will have decent education, whether they'll have decent healthcare, and so on. And when we frame it like that, we as trade unions, as NGOs, and as faith organizations have no choice but to work together. I jokingly say to my friends in the religious movement, actually I was once in Rome next to the Vatican, and I was on a television program, and I said, you know, we should challenge the Pope and all the other religious leaders to come before us and ask us a simple question. This just to those of us who are believers, accepting that not everybody are believers. So our religious leaders should say, folks, do you think God is so cruel? Because if you believe that God exists, then surely God had the wisdom of knowing that humanity would need energy. So you do think God scratched his head and said, these people are going to need energy, so let me see what I'll do. I'll take the coal, I'll put it deep in the ground, deep in the ocean, deep in the, same with oil and gas, so people have to kill themselves trying to get to it. So clearly our religious leaders should come before us and say, folks, y'all have been looking in the wrong direction. Rather than looking down for oil, coal and gas, y'all should look up and see that God gave you wind and solar to meet your energy needs. But be careful. But be careful if you use that example. There will be some clever person in the audience who will tell you, correctly so, that geothermal also comes from below. So you should say we should primarily be looking up rather than down. So let me just conclude by saying that as we go to Paris for the climate negotiations, we must not make the same mistake we made in Copenhagen. Because in Copenhagen, we vested far too much faith in our political leaders to make the right decision. And what happened to us was we got immobilized by the failure to deliver. So we will see Paris as an important point, but in a continuous struggle towards a 100% renewable energy framework by no later than 2050. It is within the grasp of human creativity, knowledge, innovation, and capacity, and this is what we must push, because we don't have a choice but to do that. So I want to end by saying that what you have done here today is a story that I will be telling in almost every opportunity I have in other countries, because sadly, the example you are setting is not being picked up in sufficient places where trade unions, faith organizations, and NGOs are working as closely as you. So I want to encourage you, deepen the alliance, broaden the alliance, give me and others some great stories to tell to other people in the world, which encourages more and more countries where the three key sectors of civil society come together. I want to end by saying that if you are anything like me, then you must go through days when you feel a bit desperate about where we are and where we need to be. When we look at where the science tells us we need to be, we are not aligned to that. We are running behind. When we look at what our children's future is calling out for, we are not responding sufficiently. So I want to say to you, I want to give to you a small gift, as we say in Africa, of a personal story, which I hope is something that I draw on for inspiration, and I hope that you might be able to. And I want to say to you in advance, though this is an inspirational story, but it has a sad tinge to it, but focus on the inspiration, not the sadness. So when I was 22 years old, I was fleeing South Africa into exile. And my best friend at that time, a person called Lenny Naidu, we had the same surname but no relation, he asked me a question. He said, "Kumi, what is the biggest contribution you can make to the cause of humanity?" I said, "That's such an easy question, giving your life." He said, "You mean like what's happening at the moment in our country where every weekend we are at funerals burying activists that have been killed by police?" I said, "I guess so." And he said, "That's a wrong answer." He said, "It's not giving your life, but giving the rest of your life." I was 22 years old at the time. My friend Lenny was way ahead of me. He was the first environmentalist I knew. And I jokingly say, I think at that time he was one of no more than 5,000 voluntary vegetarians on the entire African continent. And he was ahead of his time, and he always would say this philosophical thing. So I hugged him. We said our goodbyes and fled in different directions into exile. 2 years later, while I was still in exile, I heard that my friend Lenny and three young women from my home city were brutally murdered by the apartheid regime. There were so many bullets in their bodies, their parents couldn't recognize them at the mortuary. I had to think deep and hard about the distinction that he was making between giving your life and giving the rest of your life. What he was saying is the struggle for justice, whether it's gender justice, labor justice, economic justice, or climate justice, these struggles are marathons and not sprints. And the biggest contribution and strength that we need to have is to have the perseverance to stay the long course, to continue to push, never giving up hope that we will get those in power to act in a sane, rational, and thoughtful way for our children's future. So I want to say to you, when you hit your sad moments and your frustrating moments, please bear this in mind, that the world would be a substantially more pessimistic place were it not for each and every one of you, and it were it not for the kinds of work that each and every one of your organizations do. And I would like to conclude by encouraging you to do what you're doing and to stay the course, and to know that many people around the world are watching what you're doing and building this alliance and are inspired by it. Thank you very much.